Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Some 2 million veterans have returned from fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and one in five is thought to have post-traumatic stress disorder. All service members experience extreme conditions that can affect the rest of their lives, but this generation of veterans have injuries that are more complex, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally. The Veterans Administration has been in the headlines again for alleged misconduct and delayed care, but every day many veterans are getting state-of-the-art and state-of-the-science mental health therapies to help them grapple with PTSD. Coming up, we'll hear from one veteran who is trying a different approach, one not yet approved by the VA. Joining us now is the program manager at the Columbus VA Post Deployment Integrated Care Clinic, Teresa McCarty. Welcome, Teresa.
Thank you.
When it comes to Central Ohio, and maybe this is true across the nation, but let's talk about Central Ohio right now. How many Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans are we talking about coming home? And how many are struggling with these complex PTSD issues?
Well, we know nationally we have about over 300,000 veterans, OEF, and that's Operation Enduring Freedom, and OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, veterans that have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. In our area, which is Ohio, most of Ohio, we know that we have over 11,000 veterans that have been diagnosed officially. There are thousands of veterans that may not have been treated or diagnosed yet or have provisional diagnoses for a variety of reasons. So we know that this is an ongoing challenge, and the government has put money towards that for treatment and service-connected benefits. These numbers we get from our service connection numbers through the Veterans Benefit Administration.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Once again, I'm talking with Teresa McCarty of the Columbus VA Post Deployment Integrated Care Clinic. We're talking about PTSD and related issues today on the program and what sort of therapies there are out there and how the art and science of treating people with PTSD has changed with so many people coming home who are suffering from it. Now, it has to begin with a diagnosis, and you said 11,000 are the ones that have been diagnosed.
Correct.
That suggests there are a lot of other people, or there are other people out there that are going undiagnosed. The culture of the armed forces has been blamed in part for the lack of diagnosis.
Sure. And we know that the majority of veterans from these conflicts are male. We also know that the military has not always been a culture of acceptance of mental health challenges, and it is an invisible wound, they call it. So there has been a lot of weight put on the visible wounds, but the invisible wounds, the traumatic brain injuries, the mental health, PTSD, has been one of those kind of suck it up and drive on mentality. I think I've seen a big change over the last few years with the military being more accepting of these challenges that their returning veterans have and having services in place and referring to services. Our VA works very closely with the Ohio Army National Guard, as we have a lot of units in our catchment area that deploy. They're all combat units that have deployed multiple times, working with them to get referrals directly from them for veterans that need service with reintegration, readjustment, and possible PTSD diagnosis over time.
It's mostly male, but do women have a special stigma associated with it in that they want to be just as strong, just as this and just as that as the guys are, and are even, it seems like women often are considered more in touch with their feelings and more willing to get treatment, but is that necessarily the case when it comes to the military?
Right. And I, in being a female that had been in the military myself but not deployed, there is a very different culture for females. The males outnumber us, especially depending on what unit you're in. And there is a trying to make up for the differences that females do. So working harder, working longer in order to be as equally respected within their unit. So it is a possibility that many females haven't talked, haven't accessed services because they're trying to keep as competitive and successful in their military careers as their counterparts. they are known to be more verbal. And there, I think there have been some things in the news and media about the backlash some of them have got regarding other incidents and issues in which they've tried to speak out.
Mm-hmm.
The VA has a very specific women's program, a women's clinic, just like they have a specific program for veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. So we can provide specialized services in a very separate area of the VA to make sure that they, all women veterans, are getting the services that they need.
We've been hearing about the problems with delayed treatment in the VA. That's what's in the headlines right now, people waiting, and to the point where they're not getting it in time.
Mm-hmm.
What about mental health issues? How does that rank, and how do you manage the care of so many people coming back?
Sure. So in our, and I'll speak to Columbus because this is the only VA system that I've worked in. Our system is set up to have open door, easy access in which a veteran can walk in at any time and they will be triaged and assessed for what their needs are, whether that's medical, mental, or both. We have a mental health walk-in system that is staffed by nurses, social workers, psychiatrists that are able to address these needs and then start the process of referral for them for ongoing treatment. On my team in particular, we have our own post-deployment healthcare clinic, so that consists of providers and nurses for primary health care, but we also have nurse case manager, social work case manager, and a social worker that does reintegration readjustment counseling. So a lot of times, maybe some of these symptoms we're not closely identifying because they may have some other bigger challenges, homelessness, drug and alcohol challenges, legal challenges, financial challenges, as they're not making the money that they did. So we may do some general therapy with them, with our reintegration readjustment counselor, and from there can then link them with the appropriate services. I don't want to undermine the vet centers also in Ohio, and the one in Columbus is located on Spruce Street. That's an easy access walk-in for any combat veteran for the rest of their life to receive any sort of reintegration, post-traumatic stress disorder, military sexual trauma treatment.
A lot of injuries have been physical. There have been a lot of issues with amputations, all kinds. Is sometimes the issue of PTSD overlooked in the treatment and rehabilitation of people with physical injuries too?
I guess in my opinion, I would say no.
Okay.
The population that we serve in Central Ohio tends to be higher in mental disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, over amputations, and some of those more visible wounds. The number one service-connected disability is musculoskeletal. So musculoskeletal could mean back, knee, hip, leg injuries, and right below that are mental disorders. And that the highest in that is post-traumatic stress disorder, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders. So we are dealing with a higher population of mental health challenges for our veterans, in addition to some mild and moderate traumatic brain injury, musculoskeletal, chronic pain, things like that.
Coming up, we're going to be talking to one of the experts. She's the director of the Trauma Recovery Center at the Cincinnati VA. She is one of the top people in the field of treating people with mental disorders from war-related injuries. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Right now, we're talking with Teresa McCarty. She's program manager at the Columbus VA Post-Deployment Integrated Care Clinic. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. What makes this generation of veterans different from previous generations? Has the nature of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan meant veterans need different services when they come home as they than they have in the past? And I know you've only been with them for 6 years, but is there an institutional history to this?
I think from my perspective, what we're seeing are with this generation, it's volunteer. And it's multiple deployments per choice over a period of time. We also are more progressed in the things that we have done well and the things that we have not done well as a system for veterans. And how, what I am seeing is a real effort in trying to make sure that we have the most cutting-edge treatments for medical conditions and mental health conditions, and that we're constantly striving to make sure that we are educated, just as the general public, to treat this very important population.
To what extent are you also treating the families?
Well, absolutely. And I've always said that, you know, with a person comes a village, and the village is important for their success. So our veterans have a support system. It may be parents. You know, these are a younger veteran population. If they are not in a relationship, it may be spouses, siblings, or their buddy. And that's a lot of who brings in these veterans struggling with mental health challenges, especially post-traumatic stress disorder, given the very nature of its avoidance. And so a lot of times the family will bring in the veteran and say, something's going on, they are not the same, can you please help? And we will work with the whole group to try to help the veteran with any services they need, whether it's inpatient or outpatient services.
How much of the services are inpatient?
Well, the Columbus VA is only an outpatient facility, okay, so I can only speak to the outpatient services. But we work very closely with the VAs within our system, our VISN 10, and they may utilize inpatient services at Dayton, Cincinnati, Chillicothe, Cleveland. So we work within our system to provide inpatient services for mental health, substance abuse, and both.
Substance abuse, let's talk about that, particularly painkillers, opiates and so forth. Has that been much of an issue with this class of veterans?
I think with the chronic pain conditions, with the musculoskeletal high service connections, a lot of veterans have struggled with that. They are young people who have not been accustomed to any of this chronic pain and have a lot of it for their injuries and are on medications to treat some acute injuries and then come back to a more chronic condition. And we are working very closely with them to try alternative medications, treatment options for them, like physical therapy, chiropractic care, mental health, rather than just medications.
How well do you think the military is preparing soon-to-be veterans for the outside world? Not just the outside world and integrating back into society, but helping them understand where to go for help, when they might need help, and what to do to get help.
I think the challenge with this is we have an active duty component, and that's about 59% that deploy, and then we have a National Guard Reserve component. The National Guard Reserve folks, they live in our communities day to day, and they're constantly going back and forth from active duty deployment to home. There are systems set up, they're called yellow ribbon programs, that are to help reintegrate, readjust, link these veterans with the services, and to educate their families at the same time. Do some branches do it better than others? I am sure, absolutely. What I have seen in participating in these as a provider is the veteran is home, they want to go home, and it's very hard for them to sit through all this information and really bring it in. So we really kind of target the families to try to help identify things that happen later, as these usually happen 30 and 60, 90 days post-deployment, and we may see issues later on after deployment. So I think there's been a lot of question, concern with how these demobilizations are going. Mm-hmm. What are we looking at? What are we providing? Do we have the services? And then are they using the services? Are they really identifying the challenges they have? And a lot of times they aren't.
Yeah, I mean, a kid getting ready for college now gets at least one piece of mail every few days in anticipation of just orientation.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, do vets get the same sort of constant contact with this organization they've been involved with?
And I know that they go through classes of sorts, and they're called different things for each branches, to educate them about the services that they would need to transition off of active duty. Mm-hmm. But some utilize those services and some, I think, don't. This is where we've targeted the universities. So we work very closely with Ohio State University and Columbus State. They're a high veteran population. They have a specialized GI Bill. They are attending college at higher rates. And this is an area where we are working with their offices of military and veteran services on campus to meet the needs. We take our mobile medical unit there to provide medical exams. We have a social worker that will go there to provide any services. And then we work very closely with them to have open access for any services that the veteran may have, especially as they have challenges reintegrating into a college atmosphere from active duty deployment. And some that could be within a month.
A lot of challenges. Teresa McCarty, thanks for joining us to talk about them today.
Thank you very much.
Teresa McCarty, she is the program manager at the Columbus VA Post-Deployment Integrated Care Clinic. Coming up, the director of the Trauma Recovery Center at the Cincinnati VA. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. More than 2 million troops have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of them have served three, four, even five tours of duty. And now most of them have or are returning home soon. Their injuries range from obvious physical disabilities, such as amputations and other mobility challenges, to those you can't see, but are nonetheless life-changing. Today, we're talking about how to help heal one of the most prevalent, post-traumatic stress disorder. It's an injury that affects one in five vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, according to VA statistics. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear from Iraq and Afghanistan veteran Sarah Kaiser, who has adopted a therapy program not embraced yet by the VA. Joining us now by phone is the director of the Trauma Recovery Center at the Cincinnati VA, Dr. Kathleen Shard. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shard.
Thank you for having me.
To what extent has the prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder from these two wars affected the treatment of it? Have the wars changed how the mental health community thinks about this disorder?
Well, I think one of the positives I can say that's come out of the veterans returning is that I think there's a lot more attention by more mental health practitioners to learning about the evidence-based treatments that we already had in existence, but they're now becoming more willing to be trained in them with the goal of treating as many people as effectively as we can with these treatments.
Because there is a lot of these treatments are complicated. They're something somebody does have to be trained for. It's special.
Absolutely. You do need to be trained for these, although I can tell you on a positive note, we have data coming out of the Congo, which has horrible civil war strife going on, where we've trained clinicians who were literally high school degree terminated, and they were able to do this therapy quite effectively. So in worst-case scenarios, we can get folks in other countries trained to a lower degree, but in the United States, with our requirements for mental health services, we do insist that the person be trained to be a therapist first.
And so it begins with understanding what the problem is in the first place. Is there a physiological piece to it?
You know, a lot of what happens in the brain in terms of PTSD is still unknown, but we do have some pieces that we're aware of. We do know that the part of your brain that is supposed to keep you alive, the amygdala, that actually causes the changes in your breathing, in your digestion, and keeps you ready for that kind of fight, flight, freeze state, does become overactive in PTSD. Thus, you're being put on alert due to cues, smells, sounds in your environment much more quickly than the average person. And the other piece that we're seeing is that front part of your brain, that prefrontal cortex that is designed to have logic and reasoning and tell you there's nothing to fear, that's the dog knocking over the trash can and everything's okay, seems to be less effective in individuals who have PTSD. And between those two, you now have someone who's on over alert and overreacting physically and then not having that calming sense coming from the other part of the brain. So it's a bit of a double whammy.
I know we've learned a lot about the brain because we can see pictures of the brain alive now that we couldn't see even 20 years ago. Is that helping treatment?
Exactly. And that's you touched on the main area where I think PTSD is moving along with biomarkers is the idea of doing brain scans before and after treatment so we can actually show that activation in the parts of the brain that need to be activated and the quieting in the areas that need to be quieted.
You mentioned biomarkers. Is a certain type of person more prone to PTSD than another?
Sadly, with all things, we get to blame the parents. Mm-hmm. And in this case, again, the blame does lie there. There is a genetic component to PTSD. So if your mother or father has a mood disorder, such as anxiety or depression or PTSD, unfortunately, you are going to be more prone to having it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Right now, I'm talking to Dr. Kathleen Shard. She's the director of the Trauma Recovery Center at the Cincinnati VA. We're talking about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It's almost a household phrase these days because so many people are returning from the wars with this problem. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Shard, you are so welcome to join the conversation. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Traumatic brain injuries have skyrocketed during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. What do we know about the relationship between traumatic brain injury, and PTSD. Dr. Shard?
Well, it does appear that if you have post-traumatic stress disorder, that you're actually more susceptible to having a bad outcome from traumatic brain injury, and conversely true. If you experience a traumatic brain injury, we actually see higher rates of PTSD. So there does seem to be, when you experience that traumatic event to the brain, almost a susceptibility increase that you're actually going to have PTSD, either from that event or from other events in the past or the future. So it's too much for the brain to handle, and so we really do need to focus on quieting the individual after they experience that TBI to allow that brain to heal.
Does a traumatic brain injury complication, or does it complicate recovery from PTSD?
You know, we have data that we've published recently that shows that for people with a mild, moderate, or even a low severe TBI, they can go through these treatments that we have for PTSD as effectively as an individual who does not have a traumatic brain injury. And there doesn't seem to be a worsening. So we don't see an increase in suicide. We don't see an increase in much other symptoms other than perhaps depression. And that makes sense. If you have a traumatic brain injury, it's sensible to be a bit depressed on top of your PTSD, having to struggle with all of the pieces that go with having that post-concussive symptom.
You're a co-investigator in a very large study comparing two therapies, cognitive processing therapy and prolonged exposure therapy. Can you tell us what the difference is between them first?
Absolutely. So we're very excited. You're right. It's a 17-site study with over 900 people, and it's the largest study of its kind for PTSD. So that when someone calls me and says who should be put into which therapy, I can actually give an informed answer. So just to give a brief summary of the difference between the two, prolonged exposure is a therapy that focuses on allowing the person to really focus on the event. If they need to talk about it, if they want to talk about it, they go through it over and over and in the office to learn that the amygdala does not have to get overreactive, to learn there's no current threat happening, and it does allow you to stop overreacting physically to triggers that are in the environment that really are no threat to you, like a smell of a cologne or diesel fuel or a loud firework. But at the same time, we ask the person to go out and actually do what we would call exposures to things in the environment that are triggering them. So if the individual is fearful of going to the grocery store, we might ask them to go for 30 minutes and stay in the grocery store and see that nothing bad happens. Mm-hmm. So it's a combined exposure of exposure to the memory in the office and exposure to things they fear outside of the office. Now, that therapy lasts anywhere from 7 to 15 sessions, and it's about 90 minutes a session every week. The other therapy is cognitive processing therapy, and this therapy focuses more on that front part of the brain, of asking the brain, what meaning did you make from the trauma? And what we sadly hear so often is people blaming themselves for things they could not have controlled or predicted. And by asking them to take apart what happened and really look at the evidence, and then look at the evidence for all these overgeneralizations they're making, like all men can't be trusted, all Vietnamese people are out to kill me, all of society is unsafe. We can actually begin to take that apart and look at that realistically and look at probabilities. And the nice thing about CPT is it can be done in group or individual therapy. And for those people who feel like they just cannot tell their story, either because they signed a security clause or because they feel like it will just be too much of a burden, you don't ever have to tell your trauma in CPT in one of the versions. So we really have something for everyone.
How do you decide whether a person is right for the cognitive processing therapy or the prolonged exposure therapy?
Patient-informed choice. I strongly believe that you must choose what's best for you. And so we will give them all of the information about these therapies. And we'll actually add on that in prolonged exposure, we have virtual reality therapy, which is a version of prolonged exposure where we put them in a virtual reality machine and actually give them sights and sounds and smells that recreate that trauma. So if they really feel like they're that numbed out, they may choose that option. And by giving them all of these options, in addition to a couples-based version of cognitive processing therapy, I really feel like we have something for everyone based on their informed choice.
If you know someone also has a traumatic brain injury, will that inform you at all?
You know, what we'll do is absolutely change the treatment a little bit in case we need to not have 90-minute sessions or we need to have sessions more often during the week. But often we're using their assistive devices. So we're getting into their iPhones and making sure we have appointment reminders and homework reminders so that they don't fall off just due to the fact that they cannot remember certain things. But other than that, these treatments actually do perform at this point equally well with people with a history of traumatic brain injury. So that should not be a reason for them to not come in.
As far as memory goes, there are so many apps out there for that now. Have you found technology has been useful in this generation?
Technology has been a phenomenal asset. We can do these therapies via telehealth. We can do them to out clinics. We can actually do these therapies to your home. You never have to leave your home, and we can still get this therapy to you. But more importantly, as you mentioned, we do have an app for CPT and an app for PE. And a lot of patients would rather do their homework on their app while they're running around than trying to find time at home with a piece of paper. And that is just fine, and we really love them.
I wanted to go back to the prolonged exposure therapy. It sounds sort of counterintuitive, but I get it, and I accept that it must work at some level because you're doing it. But have you looked at whether or not it changes the brain?
That, you know, most of the research on the brain changes have been done in CPT, but there have been some preliminary studies out of Israel that have actually looked at brain changes in PE, and you do see a quieting in the amygdala.
And you said 7 to 15 sessions, all things being equal, 90 minutes every week. That, again, that's what studies have shown.
Right, and then cognitive processing therapy is anywhere from 9 to 15 sessions for 60 minutes. So we're not talking about a long commitment. We're really talking about somewhere around 4 months, you know, typically tops. And again, once a week coming in for that amount of time, and over 70% of individuals who go through these therapies walk out the door without PTSD.
And you're satisfied that they can self-select. That is what seems to work.
You know, I think when you look at research studies where you've asked patients to choose which therapy they wanted and then go ahead and randomly assign them, there actually has been some preliminary data that shows that the patients who got the condition that they would have chosen anyway tend to do a little bit better.
We're also joined right now by Sarah Kaiser. She's an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran. She joins us with her husband, Sean Kaiser. Sarah uses a therapy dog in hers, and I know that there's been, I don't like to call it controversy, but the VA is still studying the use of therapy dogs when it comes to things like PTSD.
Correct. And I think we're about to launch a very important study looking at the role of therapy dogs. And in my mind, anything that's complementary to treatment is a beautiful thing, because people will go back to their same cultures, their same family life, their same job, their same burden, and a lot of those things will put pressure on them to go back the way they were. So anything they can do will help them to interact with friends, family, their job is great. And for some people, having a dog there as a conversation piece can be helpful. Having the dog put themselves between them and a large crowd can be very helpful. Having a dog, we know dogs soothe people. All of our geriatric studies show that, will help calm that amygdala. So for people who say are not ready for CPT or PE, or maybe picked the wrong one, it was overwhelming and aren't ready to come back and try the other one, or who just are not in a place where they feel comfortable trying therapy yet, these can be fantastic things. Yoga, mindfulness meditation, any type of physical activity, animal therapy, these are all wonderful complementary things that we need to study in terms of what's their role in addition to our evidence-based treatments.
Is that, when you do studies like that for the VA, not you, but when the VA studies things like that, is there other evidence out there that other therapists are routinely using things like therapy dogs, but when it comes to the VA, it has a different standard?
Well, I think that there are therapists everywhere throughout the United States who tend to use all sorts of things. I've heard people call me wanting to do all sorts of very interesting and odd things with our veterans. And I would definitely say that I do hold them to a high standard, in that I don't feel comfortable using our veterans as guinea pigs.
But you feel comfortable with therapy dogs at this point?
Well, I think there is enough evidence that has been done over years to show the calming influence of a dog. I would not say that a therapy dog will necessarily treat PTSD at this point, but I can definitely say that it would help soothe and keep someone calm while they're trying to get to the point where they can go through PTSD treatment, or while they are going through PTSD treatment. In fact, we've admitted patients to my residential program along with their dogs.
Sarah Kaiser, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me in.
Thank you for your service.
You're very welcome. I wouldn't change it.
Introduce us to your therapy dog.
She's actually not a therapy dog. She's a service dog.
Gotcha.
Therapy dogs generally go out and help multiple people, where service dogs are trained to just pick up on their one person.
Okay.
My service dog's name is Zaria. I've had her for almost 2 years. I got her from Operation Wolfhound out in Arizona. And before I got her, I was a shut-in. I didn't leave my house. I had horrible nightmares. I had panic attacks. I was on the medication that the VA was giving me, and I didn't like the way that I felt on the medication. Since I've gotten her and I've bonded with her and she's worked for me for the past 2 years, I'm not on any meds anymore. I can go out to the grocery store by myself. I have more up days than down days. Whereas when I was filling out the VA's forms on how many days in the past month have you felt down or blue, I was filling out more than half. And now it would be probably less than five.
What kind of dog is she?
She's a Russian Wolfhound, also known as a Borzoi. They're not very common in the U.S., but they're bred very well, so their genetics are very pure, which gives them a longer lifespan than most dogs that you meet, like German Shepherds, that have been bred over and over and over again.
When you first heard the idea of a service dog, did you think it was possible?
Yes. I grew up with dogs and I grew up with animals, but it wasn't until I started researching the effects of service dogs for PTSD that I really got the whole idea on what they could do for people. I had seen service dogs helping with, you know, the blind and hearing and people with physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. But, you know, having a psychiatric disability, it's completely different. She has woken me up in the middle of the night from nightmares. She pushes pressure on my legs when I'm out in public and I start to get nervous, which releases endorphins in my brain, which helps me relax. I can stay out longer in a mall or in a movie theater because I have her. Before, I would either go out with my parents or I would go out with my husband and I would get frustrated or really anxious really quick and be ready to go home. Now I can go have fun at the zoo or anywhere else that I really want to go to and not have to worry about it because I know that she's going to watch my back and she'll alert when she feels that somebody's not safe.
Before we take a quick break, Sarah Kaiser, what were you diagnosed with?
I was diagnosed with PTSD, depressive anxiety disorder, as well as TBI, which I get migraines from. And she also alerts to the migraines.
Traumatic brain injury. And are you one of the people who is more prone to PTSD because you have a history of it in your family? Not PTSD, but a history of...
I honestly don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. Okay. Well, we'll continue our conversation. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. One in five returning Afghanistan and Iraq veterans has post-traumatic stress disorder. It can be terrifying with symptoms that include hypervigilance, sleeplessness, flashbacks, and sometimes paralyzing depression. Many veterans find healing in talk therapy, medications, or a combination of both, but an increasing number find relief in the care of an anti-anxiety canine. Still with us is Iraq and Afghanistan veteran Sarah Kaiser and her husband, Sean. Sarah, thanks for joining us, and Sean, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Cincinnati VA trauma expert, Dr. Kathleen Shard. Dr. Shard, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us now by phone from Southern California is the founder of Pets for Vets, a therapy dog training organization, Clarissa Black. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Clarissa, Pets for Vets trains shelter animals to comfort veterans, so it's kind of a win-win, right?
Correct. We do. We actually, it's almost like a matchmaking service. We meet our veterans and we find out what it is they're looking for in a dog, their personality, lifestyle, and then we go out to the shelters and look for a dog that has a temperament that will fit well into their lifestyle, and then those dogs go into homes of professional trainers and they learn the basics, and we also will customize their training plan to each specific veteran so they can learn things like nightmare behaviors to wake up veterans, check my six, but also, you know, socialization, how to be out in public, and then we also provide welcome packages with everything they need, follow-up care, and we are a lifeline of support for their pets.
How do you teach a dog to recognize the signs of anxiety in humans?
And we use a training method. We can actually get the what the anxiety trigger looks like, and we can use that as a cue for the dog to perform some behavior, like bring over a toy or come over and lick the veteran. So if pacing is one of the cues, we can teach the dog that when there's pacing, that's a signal that says, come over, bring a toy. So it's all about really understanding what each veteran needs, because everybody's different, and PTSD manifests differently for each veteran. So what we like to do is find out what's going on for that specific veteran, and how can we take their specific cues, triggers, what's going on with them, and use that in a creative way to teach the dog something that could mitigate that behavior.
Dr. Kathleen Shard, I read that the VA rule on the dogs for mental health treatment was based on the difficulty in scientifically gauging the effectiveness of the dogs. What's the difference between testing the efficacy of canine therapy compared to drug therapy, for example?
Well, I think part of the concern is that we'd have to bring the person in on a regular basis to see that they're getting better. Mm-hmm. We'd also have to be control for any medications they were taking, if they were also receiving any additional therapy. And so some of these things would have to be done and are planned to be done in an actual formal study,
right,
looking at service animals.
Is it going to be more difficult, though, than not? And you know, study's easy, caveat, but when you're talking about every dog is different, that's something that you don't have to deal with when you're testing drugs and that sort of thing.
Well, that's exactly right. Although one could say that even the therapy process with psychotherapy is,
right,
a bit different, because each individual brings something different to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another piece I want to add that it makes things difficult, is that we also have to look out for the welfare of the animal. And so when you're doing a study that involves animals, we do need to make sure that they're actually being taken to appropriate homes, that they're being brought back into the VA so that we can ascertain that the animal's being taken care of well. And it's not just a one-time visit. We want to make sure that in any type of study that involves these dogs, that we see them frequently and for a long period of time to make sure they're being handled well.
Sarah Kaiser, what about the idea of the study? I know you train dogs now yourself.
Yes.
And you're also working in training horses for equine therapy.
Yes.
So you're very invested in this now.
Yes, very much so.
What is the idea of the VA? I'm sure you understand the validity of the VA having to test these things.
Yes. As far as making sure that the animal's well cared for, that's a very big concern, even for us when we're looking to place a dog. We have a 36-question questionnaire that the veteran has to fill out before we even consider their application.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also goes with a lot of follow-ups afterwards. They have a certain amount of months of training that they have to do. And then we are always a constant lifeline for them to contact us. They have to notify us when they change addresses. So it's something where we follow up with our dogs as well. And then as far as the medications go, if the veteran gets to the point where I was, where I knew I didn't need them anymore, that would be something where we would tell them to consult with the VA before they did anything. So,
Clarissa Black, how do you talked about everything's very, very customized. You find a veteran that qualifies for the program. You approve them, I imagine, in much the same way that Sarah just described.
Yes, we do. We have extensive questionnaires before we meet. We meet in person. We do home checks. We're in constant contact. And then after the placement of the dog, we do many, many follow-ups for the lifetime of the dog. But what I've found with our program is it's not just, here's a dog, you know, good luck. We really develop a friendship with our veterans because they have to share so much of what's going on with them for us to find the right dog for them. So I end up getting, you know, text messages every day, every other day from the veterans with their new dogs. Look where we're at. You know, we're at the beach, or, you know, we went hiking. I've been invited to weddings, baseball games with the veterans that I've worked with. And so it becomes less of this, you know, you have to check in, and more of a I want to, because this helped me so much.
It sounds like you're forming a community. And I was wondering, Dr. Shard, if that could be part of it, too.
Absolutely. You know, one of the number one things that we know will help reduce developing PTSD after an event is positive social support. And for people who are coming home feeling like they're going to be judged, or they can't talk about these things, or they're no longer with this band of brothers and sisters that they can share with, it's an opportunity to really redevelop and have a context for talk other than about the combat trauma or what they experienced in theater on operations. And so for me, anything that gets individuals in communication with other people and having meaning in their life is a win as an add-on to their treatment.
Clarissa Black, you mentioned earlier that you know you get to know the vet, you then go out and you look for the dog. What can you give me an example of a vet that inspired a certain dog pick and how that worked, what you were looking for, and how you knew when you found it?
I can, and this one's kind of an interesting one. It doesn't always come this way, but I met this one veteran, and he had explained to me, he was very open, that his kind of his drug of choice at the time was fighting, and that's what he used to cope.
Fighting, violence.
Violence, yes. Okay. And I knew by speaking with him, you know, he said when he came to me to program, he was looking for a dog or a gun, and that he wanted a very large German Shepherd, you know, that could have his back and he could feel safe with. But I knew through our communication and other things that he said and through meeting him that getting him a big dog, he would probably end up in the same place that he was, that he didn't need another weapon at his side. He needed a companion and a dog that was comforting him and that sort of had the soft opposite personality. And so I ended up finding this Korean Jindo who kind of looked like a white German Shepherd, a little bit smaller, but he had this soft temperament, soft mentality. He wanted to be right there by your side. You know, he would provide that sort of the nose to the cheek whenever anything was going wrong. And when I placed them together, you know, he kind of thought, well, what is this? This isn't what I asked for. But he said that first night they slept together and he had his first full night's sleep. And what he learned with his dog was that, you know, anytime a fight would start, he would want to take his dog and get his dog out of the situation and go home and snuggle and cuddle with his dog. And one of the things he told me that was so poignant was that through learning to love his dog, he actually learned to then create social connections and bonds with other people. When he came back, he just didn't care about those connections to people in his life. And so he, but through loving his dog, he was actually able to transfer that to his human connections. And that his dog, what he lost in Iraq was his heart and his soul. And that getting his dog actually brought that back to him. And he said that he's so glad that he ended up with his dog, Rockathon, that I really knew what I was doing. Because had he ended up with a German Shepherd, a large Shepherd dog, that would have been like another weapon, he probably would have continued down the same path.
That's really interesting, don't you think, Dr. Shard?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a wonderful testament to what these alternative therapies can bring to people's lives.
Sean Kaiser, tell us from your perspective as the spouse of a returning veteran, what did you make of the dog that they brought over that day?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, Sarah and I didn't know Sarah before she was in Afghanistan, so
okay.
I only knew her from her experience afterwards, and she was very shy, very quiet, frequently had panic attacks from door shutting or slamming and outside and those kind of things. And she told me when we met that she was crazy, and I told her, you're not crazy, you're beautiful. And I knew that it was going to be a lasting, loving relationship, because I wanted to be there for her, to support her. And she came to me and asked me what I thought about her getting a service dog, because we had already had two other dogs, very big dogs. We had two Great Danes.
Oh, my gosh.
And yeah, so now we have a house full.
Yes.
And so I was on board with her. I was uncertain about it at first, but once she met her dog, Zaria, once we went to Arizona and were there for the training and learning how she used the dog for her benefit, was an obvious yes, this is what she needed.
What did you notice that said it was obvious to you?
Well, just the way that she responded in public, and her transformation with Zaria didn't happen all at once. It wasn't she met her dog and then was cured and was able to go out into public.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually, as she learned to work with Zaria and she taught Zaria to work with her, she became more independent. If we went to a movie theater and she needed to leave the movie, she couldn't go by herself when it was just the two of us. And then when the first time she got up and went out of the theater herself, you know, that was a life-changing moment for her and for me. You know, she wouldn't leave my side at a grocery store, and now she'll go to the grocery by herself. She's talking to strangers, she wouldn't, you know, initiate conversation. She would try to stay away. And, you know, as you have a very unique looking dog, as Zaria is, you know, people tend to notice and they ask a lot of questions when you're out in public, which forces her to have to talk to those people. Mm-hmm. And over time, she's learned to take those feelings and emotions, and instead of transferring that fear and anxiety into the conversation and maybe being short with those people, she's now able to have a conversation and tell them everything that Zaria does and what she is and how she does it. It's really changed her life.
You know, Clarissa Black, Sean just made a point of saying, and she was, you know, it was through all the training and training Zaria to be the right, you know, train Zaria to be her dog. I would imagine trying to identify people who would be good at that is part of what you screen for.
Yeah, so we do, we make sure that all of our trainers, we employ positive reinforcement, non-force-based training. And the idea is we want what we do and what the dogs are doing to be enjoyable, and that it's something they want to do and to mm-hmm. form a positive relationship with not only the trainer who's working with them, but also then be able to transfer that to the veteran. So, yes, the trainers are a really integral part of our program, mm-hmm. not only to teach the dog the skills in the beginning, but also then to teach the veteran yeah. how to continue on with that training with their dog.
Because anyone who's trained a pet knows what you're really doing is training yourself, right?
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question, Clarissa Black and Sarah Kaiser. You know, I know you train dogs now yourself. How valuable is it, or have you found it a value to talk to people like Dr. Shard, the people who are working on treating the, you know, the larger patient with the larger realm of remedies out there? Clarissa?
It's been invaluable. I mean, the reason I started this program was from visiting hospitals and knowing that this was something that needed to continue, not just, you know, inside the walls of the VA as therapy that was 24/7. And so as developing the program and speaking to healthcare professionals and learning from healthcare professionals, it's been invaluable to figure out the direction of the program and to make sure that we are doing something that is helpful for each veteran. So we do actually ask our veterans if we can be in contact with their healthcare providers mm-hmm. as well, so we can establish dialogue and make sure that the program is helping for the veteran and it is good placement for the dog and the veteran.
Dr. Shard, do you have people seeking your, well, consulting with you on these issues?
Absolutely. And interestingly, actually, one of the most recent conversations that came up from a group that's doing service dog training, they wanted to talk about actually protecting stress of the animal and the idea between having the dog cared for by one person and training them and then transferring them to the vet and how stressful that might be for the animal versus actually having the veteran learn how to train the animal and start the training actually from day one while in the veteran's hands. And I think that's a really novel approach to this, with the idea that why should the animal have to change hands if we can actually prevent that from happening and losing that warm connection with someone that they very much are in caring for. So I think there's a lot of work to be done here, and I'm really excited with the people that you have on the call and the work that they're doing.
Dr. Shard, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Kathleen Shard, she's the director of the Trauma Recovery Center at the Cincinnati VA. And Clarissa Black, thanks to you as well for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Clarissa Black is the founder of Pets for Vets. It's a therapy dog training organization. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Sarah Kaiser, thanks so much for bringing Zaria in and introducing us to her and sharing your story.
You're very welcome, Ann.
Sarah Kaiser, she's an Afghanistan veteran. She joins us with her husband, Sean Kaiser. Sean, thanks as well.
Thank you very much for having us.
Sarah's trained dogs, too. We'll have a link to her website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to Rachel Quimby, my assistant producer, for producing this particular show. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.